Hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast and to the latest installment of my reading of Bruce Sterling's classic 1992 book, The Hacker Crackdown, that tells the story of the early days of the online civil liberties movement and the founding of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for whom I used to work. It's been a great week. I got moved into my office and all unpacked and unpacked all my London books. And my Los Angeles books. Now I just have the Toronto books. There's about 15,000 of those, but most of those are going to get donated to the local science fiction library the next time I'm in town. But it looks great, and it feels great to have a room of my own to write in. I think I'm going to do a little vidcast from it at some point soon. I'm very house proud about it. Something else I'm very proud and delighted about. I saw Neil Gaiman last week, the guy who wrote Sandman and Stardust and lots of other great books on Antsy Boys, at a great party, and I handed him a copy of Little Brother. That's my next novel, the novel about hacker kids who fight the Department of Homeland Security and try to win back the American Bill of Rights. Very much, actually, in the tradition of Bruce Sterling's book of the Hacker Crackdown. And Neil wrote about it on his blog, and he said, among other things, "I'd recommend Little Brother over pretty much any book I've read this year, and I'd want to get it into the hands of as many smart 13-year-olds, male and female, as I can. Because I think it'll change lives. Because some kids, maybe just a few, won't be the same after they've read it. Maybe they'll change politically, maybe technologically. Maybe it'll just be the first book that they loved or spoke to their inner geek. Maybe they'll want to argue about it and disagree with it. Maybe they'll want to open their computer and see what's there. I don't know. It made me want to be 13 again right now and reading it for the first time, and then go out and make the world better or stranger or odder. It's a wonderful, important book in a way that renders its flaws pretty much meaningless." So that was just about as nice as it gets, was a tremendous Christmas present. Thank you very much, Neil. It is, of course, almost Christmas. The presents are wrapped and under the tree. The tree has been ornamented with many geek ornaments, courtesy of my fiancée Alice, who went out and found just the loveliest little collection of miniature Star Wars ornaments and Hello Kitties and Nintendos you've ever seen. So the tree is all set up in the sitting room. And I'm almost done with my stuff to do before Christmas. We went to the Brick Lane Market this morning and did the last of our shopping, got a little something for the midwife. My office is, of course, moved out, and we have the builders booked in to come and redecorate it for its next incarnation as a baby's room here. And the last thing I've got to do is write a little 1,000-word article for Forbes magazine about Romanian manga, which will be fun to write. And then I'm done. And nothing to do all through Christmas week, Boxing Week, and New Year's, and then except for, I guess, next Sunday to record you another installment of this. To do a little light blogging in the interim. It's kind of hard to stop blogging. It's a hard habit to break. I feel like I'm missing something when I don't do it. Any road, that's enough of that. Let's go on and hear a little more of Chairman Bruce's Hacker Crackdown. The reader is forgiven if he or she was entirely unable to read this document. John Perry Barlow had a great deal of fun at its
Bureaucraties of
expense in
surpassing
crime and
opacity.
puzzlement. To read the whole thing straight through without entering coma requires either a machine or a human who has had too much practice thinking like one. Anyone who can understand it fully and fluidly has altered his consciousness beyond the ability to ever again read Blake, Whitman, or Tolstoy. The document contains little of interest to anyone who is not a student of advanced organizational sclerosis. With the document itself to hand, however, exactly as it was published, in its 6-page edited form, in FRAC, the reader may be able to verify a few statements about the fact about its of the of fact about its nature. First, there is no software, no computer code, in the document. It is not in a computer programming language like Fortran or C++. It is English. All the sentences have nouns and verbs and punctuation. It does not explain how to break into the E911 system. It does not suggest ways to destroy or damage the E911 system. There are no access codes in the document. There are no computer passwords. It does not explain how to steal long-distance service. It does not explain how to break into telco switching stations. There is nothing about in it about using a personal computer or a modem for any purpose at all, good or bad. Close study will reveal that this document is not about machinery. The E911 document is about administration. It describes how one creates and administers certain units of telco bureaucracy, special service centers and major account centers, SSC/MAC. It describes how these centers should distribute responsibility for the E911 service to other units of telco bureaucracy in a chain of command, a formal hierarchy. It describes who answers customer complaints, who screens calls, who reports equipment failures and who answers those reports, who handles maintenance, who chairs subcommittees, who gives orders, who follows orders, who tells whom what to do. The document is not a roadmap to computers. The document is a roadmap to people. As an aid to breaking into computer systems, the document is useless. As an aid to harassing and deceiving telco people, however, the document might prove handy, especially with its glossary, which I have not included. An intense and protracted study of this document and its glossary, combined with many other such documents, might teach one how to speak like a telco employee. And telco people live by speech. They live by phone communication. If you can mimic their language over the phone, you can social engineer them. If you can con telco people, you can wreak havoc among them. You can force them to no longer trust one another. You can break the telephonic ties that bind their community. You can make them paranoid. And people will fight harder to defend their community than they will fight to defend their individual selves. This was the genuine gut-level threat posed by Frack magazine. The real struggle was over the control of telco language, the control of telco language. It was a struggle to defend the membrane of differentiation that forms the walls of the telco community's ivory tower, the special jargon that allows telco professionals to recognize one another and to exclude charlatans, thieves, and upstarts. And the prosecution brought out this fact. They repeatedly made reference to the threat posed to telco professionals by hackers using social engineering. However, Craig Nydorf was not on trial for learning to speak like a professional telecommunications expert. Craig Nydorf was on trial for access device fraud and transportation of stolen property. He was on trial for sealing a document that was purportedly highly sensitive and purportedly worth tens of thousands of dollars. John Nagel read the E911 document. He drew his own conclusions, and he presented Zenner and his defense team with an overflowing box of similar material, mostly drawn from Stanford University's engineering libraries. During the trial, the defense team, Zenner, a half a dozen other attorneys, Nagel, Nydorf, and computer security expert Dorothy Denning, all pored over the E911 document line by line. On the afternoon of July 25th, 1990, Zenner began to cross-examine a woman named Billy Williams, a service manager for Southern Bell in Atlanta. Williams had been responsible for the E911 document. She was not its author. Its original author was a Southern Bell staff manager named Richard Helms. However, Mr. Helms should not bear the entire blame. Many telco staff people and maintenance personnel had amended the document. It had not been so much written by a single author as built by a committee out of built concrete blocks of jargon. Ms. Williams had been called as a witness for the prosecution and had gamely tried to explain the basic technical structure of the E911 system, aided by charts. Now it was Zenner's turn. He first established that the proprietary stamp that Bell South had used on the E911 document was stamped on every single document that Bell South wrote. Thousands of documents. "We do not publish anything other than for our own company," Ms. Williams explained. "Any company document of this nature is considered proprietary." Nobody was in charge of singling out special high-security publications for a special high-security protection. They were all special, no matter how trivial, no matter what their subject matter. The stamp was put on as soon as any document was written, and the stamp was never removed. Zenner was now asked whether the chart she had been using to explain the mechanics of E911 system were proprietary too. Were they public information, these charts? All about PSAPs, ALIs, nodes, local end switches? Could he take the charts out into the street and show them to anyone without violating some proprietary notion that Bell South has? Ms. Williams showed some confusion, but finally agreed that the charts were, in fact, public. "But isn't this what basically appeared in FRAC?" Ms. Williams denied this. Zenner now pointed out that the E911 document, as published in FRAC, was only half the size of the original E911 document, as Prophet had purloined it. Half of it had been deleted, edited by Nydorf. Ms. Williams countered that most of the information that is in the text file is redundant. Zenner continued to probe exactly what bits of the document were, in fact, unknown to the public. Locations of E911 documents? E911 computers? Phone numbers for telco personnel? Ongoing maintenance subcommittees? Hadn't Nydorf removed much of this? Then he pounced. Are you familiar with Belcore Technical Reference Document TR-TSY-000350? It was, Zenner explained, officially titled E911 Public Safety Answering Point Interface Between 1-1 AESS Switch and Customer Premises Equipment. It contained highly detailed and specific technical information about the E911 system. It was published by Belcore and publicly available for about $20. He showed the witness a Belcore catalog, which listed thousands of documents from Belcore and from all the baby bells, Bell South included. The catalog, Zenner pointed out, was free. Anyone with a credit card could call the Belcore toll-free 800 number and simply order any of these documents, which would be shipped to any customer without question, including, for instance, Bell South E911 services interface to customer premises equipment at a public safety answering point. Zenner gave the witness a copy of Bell South E911 service interfaces, which cost, as he pointed out, $13, straight from the catalog. Look at it carefully, he urged Ms. Williams, and tell me if it doesn't contain about twice as much detailed information about the E911 system of Bell South than appeared anywhere in FRAC. You want me to... Ms. Williams trailed off. I don't understand. Take a careful look, Zenner persisted. Take a look at that document, and tell me when you're done looking at it, if, indeed, it doesn't contain much more detailed information about the E911 system than appeared in FRAC. FRAC wasn't taken from this, Ms. Williams said. Excuse me, said Zenner. FRAC wasn't taken from this. I can't hear you, Zenner said. FRAC was not taken from this document. I don't understand your question to me. I guess you don't, Zenner said. At this point, the prosecution's case had been gutshot. Ms. Williams was distressed. Her confusion was quite genuine. FRAC had not been taken from any publicly available Belcore document. FRAC E911 document had been stolen from her own company's computers, from her own company's text files, that her own colleagues had written and revised with much labor. But the value of the document had been blown to smithereens. It wasn't worth 80 grand. According to Belcore, it was worth 13 bucks. And the looming menace that it supposedly posed had been reduced in instance to a scarecrow. Belcore itself was selling material far more detailed and dangerous to anybody with a credit card and a phone. Actually, Belcore was not just giving this information to anybody. They gave it to anybody who asked, but not many did ask. Not many people knew that Belcore had a free catalog and an 800 number. John Nagel knew, but certainly the average teenage freak didn't know. Tuck, a friend of Nydorf's and sometime FRAC contributor, knew, and Tuck had been very helpful to the defense behind the scenes. But the Legion of Doom didn't know, otherwise they never would have wasted so much time raiding dumpsters. Cook didn't know, Foley didn't know, Klupfel didn't know, the right hand of Belcore did not know what the left hand was doing. The right hand was battering hackers without mercy, while the left hand was distributing Belcore's intellectual property to anyone who was interested in telephone technical trivia. Apparently a pathetic few. The digital underground was so amateurish and poorly organized that they had never discovered this heap of unguarded riches. The ivory tower of the telcos was so wrapped up in the fog of its own technical obscurity that it had left all the windows open and flung open the doors. No one had even noticed. Zenner sank another nail in the coffin. He produced a printed issue of Telephone Engineer and Management, a prominent industry journal that comes out twice a month and costs $27 a year. This particular issue of TE&M, called Update on 911, featured a galaxy of technical details on 911 service and a glossary far more extensive than FRAC's. The trial rumbled on somehow through its own momentum. Tim Foley testified about his interrogations of Nydorf. Nydorf's written admission that he had known the E-911 document was pilfered was officially read into the court record. An interesting side issue came up. Terminus had once passed Nydorf a piece of Unix AT&T software, a login sequence that had been cunningly altered so that it could trap passwords. The Unix software itself was illegally copied AT&T property, and the alterations Terminus had made to it had transformed it into a device for facilitating computer break-ins. Terminus himself would eventually plead guilty to theft of this piece of software, and the Chicago group would send Terminus to prison for it. But it was of dubious relevance in the Nydorf case. Nydorf hadn't written the program, he wasn't accused of ever having used it, and Nydorf wasn't being charged with software theft or owning a password trapper. The next day, Zenner took the offensive. The civil libertarians now had their own arcane, untried legal weaponry to launch into action. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986, 18 U.S. Code, Section 2701 et seq. Section 2701 makes it a crime to intentionally access, without authorization, a facility in which an electronic communications service is provided. It is, at heart, an anti-bugging and anti-tapping law intended to carry the traditional protections of telephones into other electronic channels of communication. While providing penalties for amateur snoops, however, Section 2703 of the ECPA also lays out formal difficulties on the bugging and tapping activities of the police. The Secret Service, in the person of Tim Foley, had served Richard Andrews with a federal grand jury subpoena in their pursuit of the Prophet, the E911 document, and the Terminus software ring. But, according to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, a provider of remote computing service was legally entitled to prior notice from the government if a subpoena was used. Richard Andrews and his basement Unix node, Jolnet, had not received any prior notice. Tim Foley had purportedly violated the ECPA and committed an electronic crime. Zenner now sought the judge's permission to cross-examine Foley on the topic of Foley's own electronic misdeeds. Cook argued that Richard Andrews Jolnet was a privately owned bulletin board and not within the purview of ECPA. Judge Bua granted the motion of the government to prevent cross-examination on that point, and Zenner's offensive fizzled. This, however, was the first direct assault on the legality of the actions of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force itself, the first suggestion that they themselves had broken the law and might perhaps be called to account. Zenner, in any case, did not really need the ECPA. Instead, he grilled Foley on the glaring contradictions in the supposed value of the E911 document. He brought up the embarrassing fact that the supposedly red-hot E911 document had been sitting around for months in Jolnet with Klufel's knowledge, while Klufel had done nothing about it. In the afternoon, the Prophet was brought in to testify for the prosecution. The Prophet, it will be recalled, had also been indicted in the case as a partner in a fraud scheme with Nydorf. In Atlanta, the Prophet had already pled guilty to one charge of conspiracy, one charge of wire fraud, and one charge of interstate transportation of stolen property. The wire fraud charge and the stolen property charge were both directly based on the E911 document. The 20-year-old Prophet proved a sorry customer, answering questions politely but in a barely audible mumble, his voice trailing off at the end of sentences. He was constantly urged to speak up. Cook, examining Prophet, forced him to admit that he once had a drug problem, abusing amphetamines, marijuana, cocaine, and LSD. This may have established to the jury that hackers are, or can be, seedy, low-life characters, but it may have damaged Prophet's credibility somewhat. Zenner later suggested that drugs may have damaged Prophet's memory. The interesting fact also surfaced that Prophet had never physically met Craig Nydorf. He didn't even know Nydorf's last name, at least not until the trial. Prophet confirmed the basic facts of his hacker career. He was a member of the Legion of Doom. He had abused codes. He had broken into switching stations and rerouted calls. He had hung out on pirate bulletin boards. He had raided the Bell South AMSX computer, copied the E911 document, stored it on Jolnet, mailed it to Nydorf. He and Nydorf had edited it, and Nydorf had known where it came from. Zenner, however, had Prophet confirm that Nydorf was not a member of the Legion of Doom and had not urged Prophet to break into Bell South computers. Nydorf had never urged Prophet to defraud anyone or to steal anything. Prophet also admitted that he had never known Nydorf to break into any computer. Prophet said that no one in the Legion of Doom considered Craig Nydorf a hacker at all. Nydorf was not a Unix maven and simply lacked the necessary skill and ability to break into computers. Nydorf just published a magazine. On Friday, July 27, 1990, the case against Nydorf collapsed. Cook moved to dismiss the indictment, citing information currently available to us that was not available at the inception of the trial. Judge Bua praised the prosecution for this action, which he described as very responsible, then dismissed a juror and declared a mistrial. Nydorf was a free man. His defense, however, had cost himself and his family dearly. Months of his life had been consumed in anguish. He had seen his closest friends shun him as a federal criminal. He owed his lawyer over $100,000, despite a generous payment to the defense by Mitchell Kapoor. Nydorf was not found innocent. The trial was simply dropped. Nevertheless, on September 9, 1991, Judge Bua granted Nydorf's motion for the expungement and sealing of his indictment record. The United States Secret Service was ordered to delete and destroy all fingerprints, photographs, or other records of arrest or processing related to Nydorf's indictment, including their paper documents and their computer records. Nydorf went back to school, blazingly determined to become a lawyer. Having seen the justice system at work, Nydorf had lost much of his enthusiasm for merely technical power. At this writing, Craig Nydorf is working in Washington as a salaried researcher for the American Civil Liberties Union. The outcome of the Nydorf trial changed the EFF from voices in the wilderness to the media darlings of the new frontier. Legally speaking, the Nydorf case was not a sweeping triumph for anyone concerned. No constitutional principles had been established. The issues of freedom of the press for electronic publishers remained in legal limbo. There were public misconceptions about the case. Many people thought Nydorf had been found innocent and relieved of all his legal debts by Kapoor. The truth was that the government had simply dropped the case, and Nydorf's family had gone deeply into hawk to support him. But the Nydorf case did provide a single devastating public soundbite. The Fed said it was worth $80,000, and it was only worth $13. This is the Nydorf case's single most memorable element. No serious report of the case missed this particular element. Even cops could not read this without a wince and a shake of the head. It left the public credibility of the crackdown agents in tatters. The crackdown, in fact, continued, however. The two charges against Prophet, which had been based on the E-911 document, were quietly forgotten at his sentencing, even though Prophet had already pled guilty to them. Georgia federal prosecutor strongly argued for jail time for the Atlanta 3, insisting on the need to send a message to the community, the message that hackers around the country needed to hear. There was a great deal in their sentencing memorandum about the awful things that various other hackers had done, though the Atlanta 3 had not, in fact, actually committed these crimes. There was also much speculation about the awful things the Atlanta 3 might have done and were capable of doing, even though they had not, in fact, actually done them. The prosecution's argument carried the day. The Atlanta 3 were sent to prison. Ervil and Leftist both got 14 months each, while Prophet, a second offender, got 21 months. The Atlanta 3 were also assessed staggering fines as restitution, $233,000 each. BellSouth claimed that the defendants had stolen approximately $233,880 worth of proprietary computer access information. Specifically, $233,880 worth of computer passwords and contact addresses. BellSouth's astonishing claim of the extreme value of its own computer passwords and addresses was accepted at face value by the Georgia court. Furthermore, as if to emphasize its theoretical nature, this enormous sum was not divvied up among the Atlanta 3, but each of them had to pay all of it. A striking aspect of this sentence was that the Atlanta 3 were specifically forbidden to use computers, except for work or under supervision. Depriving the hackers of home computers and modems made sense if one considers hackers as computer addicts, but EFF, filing an amicus brief in the case, protested that this punishment was unconstitutional. It deprived the Atlanta 3 of their rights of free association and free expression through electronic media. Terminus, the ultimate hacker, was finally sent to prison for a year through the dogged efforts of the Chicago Task Force. His crime, to which he pled guilty, was the transfer of a Unix password trapper, which was officially valued by AT&T at $77,000, a figure which aroused intense skepticism among those familiar with the Unix login.c programs. The jailing of Terminus and the Atlanta Legionnaires of Doom, however, did not cause EFF any sense of embarrassment or defeat. On the contrary, the civil libertarians were rapidly gaining strength. An early and potent supporter was Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, who has been a Senate sponsor of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Even before the Nydorf trial, Leahy had spoken out in defense of hacker power and freedom of the keyboard. "We cannot unduly inhibit the inquisitive 13-year-old who, if left to experiment today, may tomorrow develop the telecommunications or computer technology to lead the United States into the 21st century. He represents our future and our best hope to remain a technologically competitive nation." It was a handsome statement, rendered perhaps more effective by the fact that the crackdown raiders did not have any senators speaking out for them. On the contrary, their highly secretive actions and tactics, all sealed search warrants here and confidential ongoing investigations there, might have won them a burst of glamorous publicity at first, but were crippling them in the ongoing propaganda war. Gail Thackeray was reduced to unsupported bluster. "Some of these people who are loudest on the bandwagon may just slink into the background," she predicted in Newsweek, when all the facts came out and the cops were vindicated. But all the facts did not come out. Those facts that did were not very flattering. And the cops were not vindicated, and Gail Thackeray lost her job. By the end of 1991, William Cook had also left public employment. 1990 had belonged to the crackdown, but by 91 its agents were in severe disarray, and the libertarians were on a roll. People were flocking to the cause. A particular interesting ally had been Mike Godwin of Austin, Texas. Godwin was an individual almost as difficult to describe as Barlow. He had been editor of the student newspaper of the University of Texas, and a computer salesman, and a programmer, and in 1990 was back in law school looking for a law degree. Godwin was also a bulletin board maven. He was very well known in the Austin board community under his handle Johnny Mnemonic, which he adopted from a cyberpunk science fiction story by William Gibson. Godwin was an ardent cyberpunk science fiction fan. As a fellow Austinite of similar age and similar interest, I myself had known Godwin socially for many years. When William Gibson and myself had been writing our collaborative science fiction novel, The Difference Engine, Godwin had been our technical advisor in our effort to link our Apple word processors from Austin to Vancouver. Gibson and I were so pleased by his generous expert help that we named a character in the novel Michael Godwin in his honor. The handle Mnemonic suited Godwin very well. His erudition and his mastery of trivia were impressive to the point of stupor. His ardent curiosity seemed insatiable, and his desire to debate and argue seemed the central drive of his life. Godwin had even started his own Austin debating society, wryly known as the Dull Men's Club. In person, Godwin could be overwhelming, a flypaper-brained polymath who could not seem to let any idea go. On bulletin boards, however, Godwin's closely reasoned, highly grammatical, erudite posts suited the medium well, and he became a local board celebrity.